Now Napoleon, about whom we must talk today, came to the helm of the revolution in a flurry of accusations that the revolution had been betrayed and that he would save the revolution. And indeed, at least for a brief moment, it looked as though Napoleon might succeed in reconciling the two conflicting traditions which came from the revolution. What we might call the moderate tradition of 1791, which the Constitution of 1791 symbolizes, and the less moderate Jacobin tradition. And the problem was from the beginning to reconcile these two traditions, because after the fall of the Jacobin dictatorship and Robespierre, it was again the moderate tradition that had triumphed. How did Napoleon do this? He did it in a rather shrewd way. In some particulars, he adopted the idea of equality. Such things as equality before the law, his famous law code, the Code Napoleon, which went throughout Europe and became the basic European law code in many ways. But the Code Napoleon was equality before the law. Careers open to talent, at least nominally, theoretically, I should say, admitting everyone worthy to the political center of power. And thirdly, popular higher education, throwing higher education open to all. But these ideas of equality were, in a sense, illusory, or if you like, were shrewdly framed, so that any kind of equality under this was limited. For example, there was no emphasis on elementary education, so that, as a matter of fact, the same people who could afford it went to university as before. The throwing open of higher university was purely illusory. Moreover, the Imperial University, as you know from your sourcebook reading, was indeed a propaganda organ. So even throwing higher education open meant and was meant to mean throwing higher education open to propaganda, to the reception of propaganda. For what was really important in Napoleon's stress was the stress upon order. Order and good government. And so in the last resort, for all his talk about equality, for all his talk about saving the revolution, Napoleon appealed to the same moderate elements to which the Constitution of 1791 had appealed in the first place. Order and security against the new radicalism, against indeed any new disturbance. Napoleon did give them good government. He reorganized France in the famous 92 departments with a prefect over each. He ended the regionalism of France, which had caused a great many administrative difficulties. Moreover, by his internal politics, not only did he give better government, but he gave order through the organization of an efficient police, especially an efficient secret police, which again was a certain guarantee against the disturbances which had rocked France for so long. And yet, when it came to going out into Europe, to transforming the French Revolution into a European-wide revolution, Napoleon came to Europe again as the revolutionary hero, in spite of his internal policy, which would have given a warning about what it really all amounted to. Nevertheless, when Napoleon and his army swept across the Rhine, what was it? In one sense, it was a continuation of the old French quest for glory, a continuation, in fact, of the foreign policy of Louis XIV and Richelieu in Central Europe. But in another sense, this was the French Revolution coming as liberator to the rest of Europe, presenting itself as liberator to the rest of Europe. What happened? From Italy to Prussia, the old regimes fell. In Potsdam, Napoleon paused before the tomb of Frederick the Great, but even Prussia was swept away before the French arms. But these defeats were not just military defeats. They were much more than that, for the armies came as liberators, as the armies of the revolution. And so what happened, in fact, that thanks to the French armies, society itself was transformed in those regions. What the middle classes in Germany or Italy had not been strong enough to accomplish themselves, the French army now brought about. What did it do? It introduced the Code Napoleon wherever it went, and thereby put an end to feudal privileges. Secondly, it separated church and state wherever it went, something entirely new for Central Europe. And thirdly, it gave the middle classes, but only the middle classes, access to power through introducing constitutions in much of Central Europe, modeled on the Constitution of 1791 to a very large degree. There were in every European nation what you would call fifth columnists who helped the French army invade. For as I say, they came under the slogan, an end to feudal privilege, access to power. And so for the first time, there were fifth columns which helped them in every Central European nation. However, as always, it did not take long for the liberators to become oppressors. For the liberators didn't just go away. The liberators organized Central Europe and in many ways dominated Central Europe. They didn't just come, change the social system and left. They stayed. And staying, they became, of course, transformed from liberators to oppressors. Soon, even among the French, glory tended to dominate the revolutionary purpose. For Napoleon knew perfectly well that his base of operations was France, and that however much he sympathized with movements abroad, it was France that counted as his base, and so what he began to do was to integrate the economies and to a certain extent the political systems of the conquered nations into the French economy, into the French system. For example, just one example, Spanish sheep were transported to France, the silk industry in Northern Italy was destroyed and rebuilt around Lyon. This happened many times, that industries in what were now the occupied territories were destroyed and their economy was fastened on to France. Moreover, the new political divisions were not according to the will of the people in some vague way, but according to the interests of Napoleon. A buffer state was set up, the Confederation of the Rhine, a buffer state between France and the rest of Central Europe, the kind of state of which Louis XIV and Richelieu had always dreamt, which would in fact extend French influence directly to the left bank of the Rhine, for one of Napoleon's brothers became in fact the king of this buffer state, the Confederation of the Rhine. Well, I don't have to go into this in detail because you will read about it. But the important thing for us to remember that when the liberators became oppressors, Napoleon made another contribution to Europe as a whole. If his first great contribution was to sweep away the feudal system, his second great contribution was to oppress. Why? How can that be a contribution? It's always bad, isn't it? His contribution by oppression, well, it is in a way, hear what it is, was to create among the peoples he occupied for the first time a national feeling. And this above all in the nations which had always been disunited. Italy was here for the first time since Rome governed as a unit. And the memory of a united Italy was never to vanish, for it had now existed for the first time since Rome. But still more important, against Napoleon at the famous Battle of the Peoples, the Battle of Leipzig, all the Germans had fought side by side. For the first time in 1813, the Germans had fought side by side against a common enemy, something that had never happened, or if you want to stretch your imagination, had happened only in the early Middle Ages. The wars of liberation against Napoleon were the seedbed in which modern German nationalism grew. Quite true that at the famous Battle of the Peoples, the Prussians cut and run and deserted the rest. But as you very well know, facts can be less important than legends. And what was important wasn't that, as usual, that the Prussians cut and run when they smelled the powder. But the important thing was that, at least in theory, all Germans had fought together in the wars of liberation. It marks a vital stage, therefore, in the revival of German national consciousness. Thus, Napoleon, in spreading the revolution abroad, really spread abroad to Europe not only the ideas of the revolution, not even so much those, but rather the changes of the social system towards the Constitution of 1791, a parallel, and the great creator of a national consciousness, a very severe national consciousness among those nations. This success, of course, changed Napoleon himself. In 1804, as you know, he proclaimed himself emperor, and the Pope comes to Rome to crown him. The heir to the revolution is in the end crowned by the Pope. As you know, his brothers become princes and his wife an empress. His court gets etiquette and all of this. Why? Why that change in 1804 itself? First of all, a political reason. The royalist scare, the constant royalist sentiment could perhaps be beaten in that way. An emperor might take the demand, the sails, out of the wind, out of the demand for a king. The emperor might take the wind out of the demands to restore a king. So he used divine right ideas. The imperial catechism, which you will read in your source book, is full of ideas of divine right of kings. Secondly, in meeting the only non-defeated powers, Austria and Russia, it was better to be an emperor than an adventurer. If you were going to have diplomatic negotiations with them, it helped a great deal to be an emperor to negotiate with the emperor of Austria than just to be a Corsican adventurer. And thirdly, and perhaps most important, Napoleon's own character. Like any successful ruler, one might say like almost any successful man, he became the victim of his own delusions. He believed in the end that his lucky star would never desert him. There is no doubt that Napoleon started out at first as a very shrewd politician, a very shrewd power politician who knew what was cooking and could deal with it extremely well. In the early days, he said to a friend, for example, gratitude is a purely political expression devoid of meaning in times of revolution. Or again, in his youth, he said to somebody, people see everything through their party spectacles. Nothing is intrinsically good or bad. This suits us well, for we too have our glasses through which we watch our interests. And at this he was extremely good. This is the shrewd politician. But later on, this all changes, and you will not find such statements anymore. For example, later on, after his successes in Europe, he told a friend, oh, the fact is that you cannot escape your destiny. The one who hears himself summoned cannot resist. Napoleon became captive of the delusion of his destiny. And these delusions made him lose the solid territory of reality. He forgot his calculations. And in the end, as you know, even his brilliant generalship, it was not Napoleon I, the consul, who suffered defeat in Russia. It was Napoleon the emperor who overplayed his hand, both politically and militarily, and therefore in the end suffered defeat. He thought that he could even conquer the Russian winter and the Russian spaces. He vitally underestimated England and the importance of England's second front in Spain. Vitally underestimated that. And so, being captive in his own delusions, the end catastrophe came almost inevitably. It has, of course, been the good luck of Russia to be invaded always by people who were captured of his own delusions. The story of Hitler is not so much different than the story of Napoleon. I suppose the story of no really successful statesman is in the end that different. Hitler, too, started as one of the shrewdest politicians of the 20th century, and he, too, ended with all the success he had, deluded, moving around armies that didn't exist, thinking he could conquer the Russian winter and the Russian spaces with a stroke of his pen. There is a great deal of similarity, but that is probably the similarity of this kind of statesmanship and this kind of position rather than anything else. For obviously a man endowed with that power had to be from the beginning an actor of one way or another. And from the beginning, Napoleon kind of acted out a role on the canvas of the empire. The role of the great man, the role of the great silent man, the role of the great general, the role of the great statesman, the role of the man who knows what he is doing, even if he hasn't a prayer and just plays it by ear. All these things, to be sure you have, but in the end these people become captives of their own delusions if they've had nothing but success. And Napoleon had nothing but success for many, many years. If they had nothing for success, and I think in a sense that explains itself. Yet Napoleon's rule was, of course, never entirely repudiated. And that, too, is a measure of his success. Even in failure, he was not repudiated. After all, he did come back from Elba. France rallied to him immediately, until in the Battle of Waterloo, he was finally defeated. But when he came back, already a defeated general, probably having suffered the greatest defeat that has occurred in our period in Russia, France still immediately rallied to him. Why? Well, there is the tradition of the revolution. There is the contrast between the brilliant Napoleon and the restored Louis XVIII. Louis XVIII, fat, slow, uninspiring, hardly cut out for glory. There is, therefore, the constant association which will remain between Napoleon and glory. And there is also something else as a result of the revolution. this kind of popular dictatorship. For you now have had it twice. You have had it once with Robespierre, and there it was somewhat different. For Robespierre had a definite ideology, a definite theory. He came to power in a definite kind of rather desperate revolutionary situation. But the popular dictatorship of Napoleon was something quite different again. For Napoleon also came to power in a moment of crisis, so to speak. But Napoleon had to keep it up, as Robespierre never had to. Robespierre, after all, ruled for 2 years. 2 years of where the whole revolution was in question, where foreign armies were on French soil. Napoleon ruled, I forget now because I'm not good in counting, but at least 12 or 15 years, whatever it is. Anyway, a long time. And during that time, to be sure, he was a conquering general. But still he found that he had to keep it up. Because he was caught, and the first time you have seen it, because it is the first time it has happened, in the momentum of popular dictatorship. What does that mean, the momentum of popular dictatorship? Because he was dependent, in a sense, on the general support of France. In a sense, on the public opinion, on the loyalty on the army, but also on a vague kind of public opinion. At least he was dependent on the public to the extent that no counter-revolution should be allowed to take place. And here a secret police was not enough. You had to have more. So that Napoleon had to capture and hold the public imagination. And to capture and hold the public imagination drove him forward as a conquering hero, not only posing as the defender of the revolution, not only posing as the champion of law and order. That's all very well. That you can do if you have an institutional framework to back you up. But Napoleon had no institutional framework. He didn't work with a parliament. He didn't work with elective representatives. There was Napoleon and there were the people. It is really the first time in history that you have seen this phenomena. For Cromwell, again, always tried to get a parliament, get representative institutions. But this is the first time that you see then a phenomena that is portentous for the future, for it will be one of the most important phenomena in European history, in history general, the phenomena of popular dictatorship, of what it takes to keep it, of what it takes to manipulate the masses, to capture their imagination. And what it took, as far as Napoleon was concerned, was not only being a conquering hero, was also setting up a court with princes, with an empress, having court, fastening on, therefore, to a kind of tradition, seeming to fasten on to a national tradition, as you didn't have any parliament or institutions. You tried to fasten on to a national tradition, a court, a princess, an empress. He also found what every ruler has found since, who didn't have a parliament or elected representatives, that you have to keep doing interesting actions. So whether these actions are his empress giving birth, receiving somebody at court, having a conquering army, you always have to have momentum. You cannot stand still, for then you are lost. You lose the public imagination. Somebody else might easily capture it. Napoleon, therefore, is the first example which you have of a popular rule, a direct popular democracy, in a way, direct popular rule without intermediate institutions. It is, in a way, the beginning of this kind of rule in Europe, much more than Robespierre, who was definitely wedded to an ideology, who didn't confront this because he wasn't in there long enough to confront that problem. But every popular dictator, if you like, from now on, will confront that problem, and it will be one of the most difficult problems that they have to confront. We can see, therefore, that the importance of Napoleon goes, of course, quite outside his individual actions. To be sure, Napoleon is also the pacemaker, not only of modern ideas of popular dictatorship, but also of modern militarism. For under him you have, for the first time, a citizen army led by a general dictator who cared nothing for human lives. One of his more useless battles had 20,000 dead, a scale that was quite unknown hitherto. Napoleon won his victories by massive attacks. He never counted human life for very much or anything. Nor did Napoleon use his army for the first time for limited objective. As I told you before, Frederick the Great conquered Silesia. He stopped. He didn't go on to make an entry into Vienna. Napoleon had no longer any limited objective. The objective was now unconditional surrender to the revolution, to carve up the map of Europe according to his wishes. This, of course, comes from the French Revolution, for in a sense he could make use of the fact of extending the idea of the despotism of liberty against tyranny. He could extend it now to all of Europe, and he could say, and he did say, that I come to Europe in the name of the despotism of liberty against tyranny, so that your old regimes have to fall utterly and new regimes have to be constructed. Napoleon did, of course, most of the constructing, but new regimes have to be constructed. So it is very typical that out of the first great modern revolution, out of the first great modern revolution, with all its ideological thrust, comes the first unconditional warfare. You war no longer for territory, you war for liberty. And a war for liberty means the unconditional surrender of the anti-libertarians, which are all your enemies in this case. So what you have here is the beginning of unlimited warfare, which we must certainly list as one of the important products here. Though, as a matter of fact, it was not yet to triumph, not really until 1918, not until the Americans, with their moral posture, came to make the world safe for democracy. Then you had it. This is a historical fact. Woodrow Wilson is the man who did more to spread or to transform the First World War into a war of unconditional surrender. And in the Second World War, it was Roosevelt who advocated unconditional surrender, not Churchill or the others who still had this idea of limited warfare. Well, you can approve or disapprove, but that is in fact the case. That you have it beginning after the French Revolution, but you will find that in the 19th century, most wars are still wars for definite territorial objectives. But you will find that that changes only European-wide in the First World War, when you fight no longer for Silesia and you fight no longer for Pomerania, you fight for democracy. And then those who are opposed to democracy must go. And that is a doctrine already of unconditional surrender, as indeed it became then in the Second World War, quite overtly. We must say, therefore, to summarize it, that Napoleon's contribution then must be seen on several levels. First of all, on the level of what he actually did, not only for France, for in France, in a way, he liquidated the revolution. Law and order, a kind of phony equality. He liquidated the revolution, in a way. Hell, you can't keep up revolution. We'll come back to that next week. He liquidated the revolution. And the end, of course, even when Napoleon had fallen, was that what triumphed was what Napoleon had really been for as well. The Constitution of 1815 was very much like the Constitution of 1791. What triumphed in the French Revolution and with Napoleon are the people who made the revolution in the first place. That is to say, the middle classes, the upper middle classes, in effect, triumphed in 1815. Secondly, Napoleon brought the revolution to Europe, and you mustn't underestimate it. The old regimes fell. The feudal age was ended for Europe. There was equality before the law. Feudal privilege did go. You must really not underestimate that, because it is important. And thirdly, by becoming oppressors from being liberators, also something that's very common, depends how long you stay, from being liberators to oppressors, he made another contribution, which he didn't intend, namely the stimulation, and really the start, of national consciousness, which, however, fastens on to the nationalism of the French Revolution. This idea that what mattered is not the dynasty, but what matters is the fatherland. La patrie, only now it was the German fatherland, or the Italian fatherland, because oppression bred wars of liberation, and as you all know, wars of liberation are the essence of national consciousness. So the wars of liberation are a vital step in German national consciousness and the Italian conflict in the conflict of Italy as well. Finally, did Napoleon make a lasting contribution to the map of Europe? And in a sense, there we must say yes again. The Congress of Vienna, about which you will read, tried to put the clock back, but it could not. The map of Europe was irrevocably altered. The architects of the new peace might hate the revolution. And as you will read in your source book, people like Metternich wanted, as they said, lead people from excitement to rest. But this the Congress did not quite do. For one thing, it could not turn the clock back in Germany. To be sure, Germany didn't become united, but there were now fewer German states. It could not even turn the clock back in Italy completely, so that you must study the map of 1815. In a sense, Metternich was quite correct. He did lead the people from excitement to rest. For you must not forget that the peace in Vienna is probably the most successful peace in the history of Europe. The map of Vienna, which you must study, of 1815 will last, certainly until 1870, in its main features, really until 1918, but certainly until 1870. Why is it so successful? Largely because it managed to establish a feasible balance of power, largely because it has turned around Austria and the Austrian Empire, which is the nexus of the balance of power in the Treaty of Vienna. France, which in Vienna was not destroyed, but indeed emerged quite strong, and which became the second kind of nexus of the balance of power. And at least until 1870, a European balance of power centered on Austria and France seemed to be extremely successful. So that while they did not turn the clock back completely, it must be said to Metternich's lasting credit that he had a great grasp of the balance of power. And that he, as he constructed the balance of power at Vienna, that balance of power was to last from Vienna to 1815, and indeed, in a sense, to 1918. Finally, the French Revolution was important just by its existence. As I told you before, from now on, this will be the revolution for all European revolutionaries.
First thing they will do is construct barricades. Well, hell, they did that in France last May.
And of course, there was no reason for these barricades, really. It's just a thing you do. You construct barricades. I'm quite serious, because there was no reason for these barricades at all. You construct barricades. The second thing you do in France is you get hold of the city hall and you proclaim from its balcony. That happened the French Revolution, 1870, and it happened again in May. Those are the two things you do. But the French Revolution became the revolution until, of course, as I told you before, the introduction of the machine gun, when all you could do storming the Bastille was to die. Napoleon became important then as a model for the popular dictatorship. The popular dictatorship, which will also have a great, if not glorious, future in the 19th century. Now, all of this said, we still have two lectures, and there are two things that I must still do. In the next lecture, I want to sum up around problems, and I think that's about time I did this again. You can have your own judgments. There was a little pamphlet out which flooded the historians' convention in New York, in which one of our assistants wrote a rather amusing paragraph in, headed "A Small Success," which was about the radical caucus in this cause. I didn't make that value judgment, he did. A small success, but in that little passage it was also said that this was, after all, ruling class history, and history with a ruling class bias, and where is the poor peasant? Well, we'd better drag him to light next time, I think. And talk a little bit about some of the problems involved, such as the problem of the people, for example, and other things. So that in the first summary lecture, I want to talk about problems like that. I think it is probably important at this point in history to do so. Second of all, and by the way, no, wait a minute, you still have questions. Second of all, and this will be very good, because I will talk about this on Wednesday, and you can think about it, because next Monday evening we will have the last of these get-togethers we have, so that this will work out quite well. In the last lecture, then, I will give you a summary from a slightly different angle, and sort of tie the course up and put a ribbon around it and wish you a happy Christmas belatedly, because I think that's quite important for you to do, at least for most of you. So that we shall do these two things then from now on. And now I'm open to questions. This little pamphlet put that down also as a major revolutionary thing, having questions after lecture. I rather enjoy it and don't...